First edition here on WEAA 88.9. I am Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Wednesday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name. S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I will share it with the people, unless you don't want me to. Of course, I won't do that. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Kenyatta Moon will be here. She's the host, co-host of the Holistic Living segment. She's founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought, talking more about self-care, being clean and clear, and how to bridge that into having the best summer ever. Well, I go for that. I want to have the best summer ever. Really do. Lamont Summers will also be here. He is the assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He will have the media report, plenty to talk about. That's all coming up in the second hour. A little bit later in the first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Stephen Janis and Taya Graham of the Real News Network, talking about law enforcement, reporting on law enforcement and politics. But before that, our friend, a defense attorney and legal analyst, J. Wendell Gordon, is on the phone. Jay, always a pleasure to hear your voice, man.
It's my pleasure to be on your show once and again.
Once and again.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir, of course. Jay, I'm going to tell you, man, these past few weeks in particular, specifically, I have not had a lot of time to pay much attention to anything on Facebook. But when somebody's post makes me stop and read an entire post of several paragraphs, that's saying something, brother. I'm going to get to that post in a minute because it was profound. It really was. And that's not unusual for you. But before we even get to that post and those observations, I want to get your take on the acquittal on all charges of the police officer who was charged in the death of Philando Castillo last year. That horrific video surfaced. Right after he was shot, his girlfriend had the courage and tenacity to keep the camera rolling as this officer. Then there's this new video that has surfaced in the wake of the acquittal of the police officer, the dash cam video, even in some ways more horrific than what we saw originally. So just let's get your take on, I mean, we know how it's possible, but analyze it for us.
Well, you know, it's another tragic story of police, some would call it misconduct. It depends on which lens you look at it through, but it's definitely police intolerance of the African-American, particularly, at least in this particular situation, the African-American male. There's always... First of all, you can't protect something you're afraid of, and that's always what I've said. You can have these police officers on the job, and they're afraid of their own shadow, and you're giving them a gun and the license to take someone's life. And these particular officers are unfit to be doing their job. Now, in the Philando Castillo case, you know, he had a concealed weapon permit, and he brought it to the officer's attention. And apparently he was trying to either show the officer his license to carry the permit or just retrieve his license. And that's what I wasn't sure about. In the second video, the officer is telling him, don't reach for it. But at the same time, you know, you don't have to pull out your weapon and just blast up an entire car with family inside. I mean, it was a busted taillight. I think that's the purpose of the stop, or his taillight was out. how do you go from your taillight being out to being dead on the side of the road? It's ridiculous. And I think that these officers, I think really there needs to be a change in the common law. There needs to be more accountability because the law is just not capturing incompetent officers. And that's what it claims that it's supposed to do. That's why there's so much leeway for police officers, because the law is supposed to filter out the incompetent ones, but the incompetent officers are making it through the filter, and they're causing, they're wreaking havoc on our community. They're causing substantial damage and a lot of harm to our citizens.
But even
so, go ahead.
I was going to say, even when, I'm in total agreement with you, Jay. There are filters in place that these officers slip through,
right.
go through. But even right. even with those filters, it seems like the criminal justice system just is not equipped to find officers guilty of killing or
right.
hurting people of color.
We're saying the same thing. And when I say filters, I mean immunity.
Right.
Officers have immunity, official immunity, to protect their negligent conduct.
Right.
Now, their intentional conduct is not protected, but negligent conduct in a manner where their discretion is employed,
right.
they're protected. And so that's how these, and our society views officers, servicemen, and folks like that as elite citizens. So they're giving them something that's beyond, you know, a doubt. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, they have to be, if the facts say one thing and they say something, and if there's some reasonable, albeit tenuous, you know, excuse for the conduct, they're going to get the benefit of that doubt. That benefit that they enjoy is not enjoyed by your everyday common citizen. And so, really, it speaks to jurors and we as a society being programmed to revere, almost like worship, you know, the police and certain segments of our society. They revere and worship them and believe that they can do no wrong until they're on the receiving end of wrongful conduct. So they don't understand. So when the officer says, you know, don't try to reach for it, and then immediately starts to blast off with his weapon, they say, well, you know, he told him not to reach for it. And in doing that, they separate themselves. They say, well, this couldn't have been me because I wouldn't have done what the officer said, or if he had just listened, you know, he'd be here today. But who knows whether or not he heard the officer say or understood what the officer said, because when he said don't reach for it, it wasn't like he said it in a heavy voice, and he could have been reaching for his license and registration that may have been in the same compartment as the weapon. You know, who knows? We do know that he asked for his license and registration.
Right.
If he, him, me, any, a lot of people keep their registration in their glove box.
Of course.
And so if he's reaching for it, he may not have necessarily been reaching. His gun may have been someplace else. And he may have been reaching for his license and registration. Minnesota is a concealed weapon permit, concealed to carry. Basically, you can carry your firearm with you,
right?
In Minnesota, so it's not even unusual for individuals to be traveling with a firearm in their vehicle. So, in this particular case, it's awful. It's pathetic. To me, I feel as though the officer is a disgrace, and I understand that that's a controversial opinion, but that's how I feel about it. It's nothing that anyone's going to be able to say to convince me otherwise. This was a very bloody murder to me, and I understand the excuse that he's trying to make up after the fact, but that's how I view it.
Officer Geronimo Yanez is the police officer we're talking about from the St. Anthony Minnesota Police Department. He again acquitted of second degree, and the charges, Jay, seem dubious to me. Even second degree manslaughter was the charge actually that he was acquitted of. As you said, it looks like on tape a bloody murder. But we talk about this case even as the breaking news comes across the wires that former Wisconsin officer who fatally shot Seville Smith and sparked days of unrest. Acquitted of all charges.
Mm-hmm.
Acquitted of all charges. This is par for the course now, Jay. I mean, how many times, how often do we have to go down this same road before we decide that this system, this alleged criminal justice system, is absolutely unequivocally broken when it relates to people of color and poor people?
Right. And it's going to happen with the law, but I don't know if Congress can do it. I think that the Supreme Court or the federal courts are going to have to establish a better test for determining whether officers' conduct falls outside of the realm of mere negligence and into a realm of criminal conduct. And I think that this particular case certainly presents a good set of facts where such a test could be created. I think when you have a case such as this, and you know, officers are always trying to say, we want to make sure we make it home safe first. Well, any person, anytime you make contact with the person, that's a threat. And you could be placed in fear basically because you told somebody to do something and they failed to do it. Does that give you the right to shoot them? Well, according to the Castile case, it does. And so I think that the law needs to be tightened up with regard to the discretion that is afforded officers when they use force, deadly force, in situations, all situations, but in particular situations such as this, where they didn't give this guy a chance to explain much of any of his activity. He may have wanted to say, my license is in my glove box. Who knows? It's shoot first and ask questions later, and that, to me, will ultimately lead to straight anarchy, and it places good officers' lives in danger as well, because if a person is stopped and they are pre-programmed to believe that this officer is going to kill me, so let me kill him before he kills me, that's not good for society either. So it's a very slippery slope, but I think at the end of the day, the citizens will mount the most carnage under the laws as they present themselves today, as opposed to officers. It's always an officer who's afraid, but it's always a citizen that comes up dead. And, you know, these officers are supposed to be trained to de-escalate situations, and here we are as citizens. We have to train our own people how to de-escalate a situation with an officer in order to evade, you know, the loss of life. So it's a very dangerous situation and very dangerous times we're in. And I don't know. We always say, wake up, wake up, wake up. And, you know, the one thing is that's easy to do that we should not ever find ourselves doing is losing hope or the will to fight. These fights are just fights that are going to have to be waged. They waged war on us as soon as Obama got in office. And we've been sitting back in the armchair watching the housewives, but it's steadily picking us off. Mm. And we just have to, I know we've been mobilizing and trying to figure out exactly what we need to do, but we definitely need to be doing something as opposed to nothing. And we need to be, you know, involved in our civic activities, participating and satisfying our civic duties. We just need to be all about civics right now. Civics is just extremely important in today's culture.
Understood. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. I'm on the phone with a defense attorney and legal analyst, J. Wendell Gordon, talking about the acquittal of the officer, Geronimo Yanez, the police officer with the St. Anthony, Minnesota Police Force, acquitted of all charges. The most serious one, I believe, was the only second-degree manslaughter relating to the murder of Philando Castillo in 2016. The footage, the aftermath of the shooting, caught on videotape. New video has surfaced now of the dash cam footage as well. Even more harrowing than the footage that we saw originally. Jay, I literally, my computer just froze, so I cannot access your Facebook post, but it was still stunning. You compared and contrast the treatment of a young black woman, who was, I believe, a medical student.
Medical student. Had a resume out of this world. Yeah. I mean, 26 years old, had a 3-page resume in 10-point font. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Full of all of these personal achievements, professional development, and just a well-accomplished young lady who had a bad night. Like, the conduct that she was, you know, accused of was, you know, pretty much indefensible. But at the same time, it should not have destroyed her entire life or set her in a path to really have to work extremely hard to get back on the right track of a path that she had been pursuing ever since high school. I mean, they tried to really hurt her bad. And so you have this African-American medical student who's facing a second-degree assault charge on a police officer, fueled perhaps by, you know, the ingestion of, you know, some type of alcoholic substance. And she was charged with, you know, a variety of offenses, over 20 offenses, no doubt. Her lawyer was able to negotiate her offenses down to 2. There were video cameras and body cams. You know, the body cams were working on this time.
Yeah, of course.
They were working good. You know, they got it all. And most of it was just the real charge, even though she's charged with several criminal and traffic offenses, most of it was just contempt of cops. It was just she was doing a lot of mouthing to the police, and that's what really upset them more than anything else.
Right.
And they roughed her up, and always when police rough you up, they're going to charge you with an assault on a police officer to justify their own conduct. And the mouthing off didn't help. And as I said, her position was pretty much indefensible, but she had some mitigating circumstances that were, you know, certainly worthy of consideration. I think the court did consider them. And but by the time her case was, you know, called and an agreement had been reached, she went from like 27 counts of criminal and traffic offenses to 2. And so it wasn't the lawyering in the case because, and the 2 counts were misdemeanors. Even the assault on the officer was a misdemeanor count, no injuries or anything like that. And she fled to that and another traffic offense. And she was given a suspended sentence on the assault on the officer with a fine and probation before judgment on the traffic offense. So that was that, and, you know, everyone in the courtroom thought that was the end of it. But then behind her comes this other gentleman charged with the same offense.
These happened in this. I didn't know these happened in actually the same courtrooms.
Same courtroom, same judge, the very next case.
Wow.
After the African-American medical student case was called, this other case was called, dealing with this white male, about 65 years of age, about 6'5", 6'4", 240, 60 pounds, somewhere in there. And the reason why I give you his size dimensions is because this man was walking in a park in Montgomery County, and there was a woman walking with, she was a nanny, they said, walking with a young boy who she was babysitting and the young boy's dog. Well, the dog had relieved himself, number 2, in the park, and the man believed himself to be the world police, you know, was demanding that she clean up the poop. And she refused to clean up the poop because the poop was runny and liquidy, and it wouldn't necessarily fit into the bag. So this white guy scoops up some of the poop on a stick or on a bag or however he did it and smears it all over the nanny's shirt.
All right.
And pushes her. And then when the 10-year-old boy steps up to defend the nanny, he strikes the 10-year-old boy in the chest.
Now, and the reality is that, and I have it up now on my screen, mm-hmm. but he had I mean, this is a man who is guilty of, has a past, that's a criminal past.
Right. He had a criminal record.
First degree rape.
Had no criminal record whatsoever. This man had been convicted and served jail time for first degree rape. And this judge, as you know, he gave my client, he gave the young lady a conviction for the assault on the officer, but he allowed this rapist who's charged with the same charge, he gave that rapist probation before judgment on the second degree assault charge, and he assaulted two people, a 10-year-old boy and a woman. More aggression towards women, because the rape charge definitely demonstrates his aggression towards women. And then he smears feces on this woman, and he gets probation before judgment, and the medical student does not. And that made me feel some kind of way. I was like, you know, that bothers me. And I'm not sure if the judge meant to do it, or he just did it. He felt as though was okay. He saw the humanity in this rapist that he did not see in this medical student, and he thought it was okay to ensure that this white male rapist would be able to maintain his gainful employment. He thought that was just. And to hinder the future prospects for employment of this African American
who is
medical student
starting out in
her fourth year,
starting out in life, and this rapist was nearing his retirement. Actually,
nearing his retirement, and he indicated that. He said his lawyer was like, "Well, Judge, same thing that the lawyer for the African American lady said, Judge, if you put this conviction on his record, he won't be able to." Work on several job sites because he's a crane operator. Hmm. And the judge, you know, he wrestled with that for a minute, and then he gave him probation before judgment. And, I was incensed by that. I was incensed by it.
Well, I think
I think the
reality is that the vast majority of people, especially people of color, would be incensed by it also. But I think it is indicative. I don't think. I believe fully that it is indicative of where we are, where we've been, and unfortunately where we're going, and unfortunately also we are out of time. But Jay Wendell Gordon, defense attorney and legal analyst, Jay, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for your insights, and thank you for this observation and pulling our coats to this really just reminder of where we are as a country, where we are specifically within the criminal justice system.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me and allowing me in your airways to share this story.
Of course. Jay, thank you, man.
The more we talk about these issues, the more it'll get out, and I think the more people will be inclined to do something about it.
I hope so.
Yes, indeed.
I hope so, brother. Thank you, Jay. I appreciate you, man.
Thank you. I appreciate you more.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Ted Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network reporting on law enforcement and politics. Stay tuned. You are listening to First Edition. First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host, making the transition from it's an interesting transition, an interesting segue from legal matters from the attorney's perspective, Jay Wendell Gordon, to the work of the Mod Squad, that is Ted Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. My friends, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Sean, how
are
you?
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. What are we talking about?
Well, there are a couple things we can talk about. Mm-hmm. The another verdict for an officer who has been charged with shooting on the same day or roughly after they finally released a dash cam video of the shooting.
Philando Castillo.
Mm-hmm. And, we were talking about it in the car because this is very germane to Baltimore.
Absolutely.
And we were discussing because he was acquitted. You know, the officers involved in Freddie Gray were acquitted. The woman, I think it was in Tennessee or was in Kentucky, who shot the man who was standing outside of Oklahoma.
Terry Crutcher.
Yeah. Have all been acquitted. And, you know, we were just wondering, thinking about it, you know, if prosecutors are going to be the main driving force in police reform, then things are, I wouldn't blame a prosecutor right now for saying, I don't want to charge this because it would be extremely hard to get a conviction.
They wouldn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, not only because it would be difficult to get a conviction, but because in many cases they have alienated the law enforcement, their local law enforcement.
Yeah.
And you can certainly...
Who would want to go through it?
Exactly. And so not only do they alienate their local law enforcement, not only is it difficult to get a conviction, but then you also have lost on a very public national stage.
Yeah. I mean, in the video... seemed to me to be very compelling evidence. The video of Philando Castillo's shooting, the officer gives him like literally less than a split second, goes, you know, don't pull it out. He tells him he has a gun. And Tay and I were talking in the car. Right. It wasn't enough time to comply.
Exactly.
Like if he wanted him to put his hands up, he just didn't. If he was putting his hand back to get his wallet, his arm's still moving. He didn't have time to stop.
That's true.
Put his hands up.
Because I was thinking there were people, and of course, as you can imagine, there's quite... Quite an incredible social media discussion going on, and there are people who see this tragedy as what it is, an incredible tragedy and a loss to the community, and there are other people who say, well, he didn't do what the police officer told him. The police officer said, don't move, don't pull out your gun.
Yeah.
And so if he, as Stephen said, if he had reached into his pocket
to pull out his wallet,
and the officer says, don't pull out your gun, if he moved in any direction, it would appear that he wasn't complying.
Yeah.
He didn't give him enough chance to comply.
I mean, it just seems such a split-second decision, you know, we were talking about.
And 8 shots into a car with a woman and child in the car. And I don't know if you've seen the footage of... Diamond Reynolds in the back of the car with her daughter.
Who is his boyfriend.
Yes, thank you.
Who Facebook Live the whole thing.
And just amazing that she had the presence of mind to do that. But when she's in the back seat of that car and she's handcuffed and she yells an expletive and says she wishes she could get these cuffs off. And her daughter says, don't, Mom, I don't want you to get shooted. And then her daughter starts crying. And then she says, I don't feel safe in here. I wish the car was safer.
I want to share something with everybody, and this recently happened to me, and I don't think I have said this to anybody specifically, but I recently stopped for a very minor traffic infraction in Kent Island at night, someplace where I've had spent a lot of time, obviously, and so I'm wondering what the issue is, because I didn't know what it was. I found out later, but it was something very minor. And as the officer is walking towards me, I'm always looking in the rear view because that's what I do.
Yeah. So I'm not unreasonable.
And as he's walking towards me, I clearly see him unclip his gun holster.
Just in case he needs to pull it out on you.
So when he comes to the car, he knows me. He's a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
The cop was a friend of mine.
Oh.
And he's like, Sean? And I'm like, yeah, bro. I mean, what's going on?
Wow.
And he was very polite, very congenial and everything. Mm-hmm. Didn't even ask me for my license. Said, have a good night, whatever. Mm-hmm. But before he knew it was me, when he thought it was just another black guy driving through Kent Island, unclipped the belt holster. Unclipped the gun holster. Ready for action.
That's disturbing.
Just in case.
Which
nice guy, but
which also prompts the question that much of this of what we've seen happen. Why on earth pull you over anyway? I mean,
well,
what's the point?
He ran the tags, and the license, the plates weren't expired.
Yeah,
but he ran the tags because he saw a black guy he didn't recognize at first.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And that's what happened.
I mean,
he didn't know it was me.
So you're saying the probable cause was that you were black,
right?
In Kent Island.
Driving through Kent Island, and he saw a black man driving a black vehicle,
and that was it.
He ran the tags, pulled me over, and as he's walking towards,
And was he state police or Ken Island?
He was a sheriff.
That's horrifying, badly that could have gone.
Yeah, I mean, the Eastern Shore is like a constant, you know. But you see that in Towson, too. County cops pull over. 90% African-American. They do on Lock Raven. They do it on York Road. Almost all of them are African-American.
Yeah.
And it's a technique, I guess, they feel like. You know, but what has it netted us? Just nothing.
Lawsuits.
Yeah. People dead. And I don't think it has anything to do with crime. I mean, that's the thing, Sean. You know, it really doesn't prevent crime. It doesn't solve crimes. You know, we have, what, 200,000 unsolved murders in this country? How on earth is pulling over someone randomly that you don't know going to do anything to make a place safer? 99.9% of the people you pull over, it's going to be people driving.
I said to him, why'd you pull me over? He said, I ran your plates. I was like, oh, okay. I was just like, all right, bro. You know, so when I, next time I see him, I'm going to ask him, yo, what was that? I mean, I'm laughing, but it could have ended horrifically.
Of course.
What if I had made one of those furtive movements?
Gotten out of your car.
Which is 100% totally
reasonable. And within your rights, and then people do all the time, and they freak out when you get out of your car. I know, because I've been pulled over like 50 times.
Yeah.
I mean, no, maybe 60.
So I just wanted to add that into the conversation. Again, I hadn't shared that, literally have not shared that with anybody. I mean, a couple of people knew I got pulled over, but I had not told anybody. Wow. Specific,
that's terrifying how badly that could have gone.
Yeah.
So I guess what we need to have is a black friend program for police officers.
Right, exactly.
Every police officer needs to get a black friend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Spend some time with them.
Yeah.
Maybe that would help.
I don't know. So let's continue. We have some sound from another story that you were working on
We spoke with Dr. Leanna Nguyen, who is the commissioner for the Baltimore City Health Department, and she shared with us that Baltimore City is absolutely in crisis. And the reason why it's in crisis is because we have an incredible number of opioid overdoses in Baltimore City. As a matter of fact, one-third of all the opioid overdoses that occur in Maryland occur in the Baltimore City limits. And so there is a drug called Narcan. The generic name is naloxone, and this drug can save lives. It is not just one of the drugs that can be used. It is the drug. It is the best
drug. In terms of when people overdose.
When someone overdoses, they're going into respiratory arrest. They are literally dying. An injection of the drug or nasal spray of that drug can absolutely save their lives. It is a miracle.
Well, let's listen to a clip with Dr. Nguyen, and then we'll talk afterwards.
The problem is that we are being priced out of the ability to save lives. The price of naloxone has more than doubled. It's a generic medication. The price has more than doubled. And with the increased demand, with that high number of people who are overdosing, especially because of fentanyl, which is a medication that's many times stronger than heroin, because of fentanyl, because of heroin, because of other prescription drugs that are killing our residents, we need Narcan more than ever. And we just don't simply have enough. We don't have the resources to purchase it, and we need the assistance from our state and federal partners to help us to meet the high demand, the high urgent need that there is in Baltimore City. Nearly 700 people died from overdose in Baltimore City in 2016. That's about 2 people a day in our city who died when we could have saved their lives. In our city, there are over 21,000 people who use heroin, many tens of thousands who use other drugs, including other opioid prescription drugs. These are all individuals who are at risk for overdosing. And remember, too, that a person could overdose after having surgery and being prescribed narcotics and overusing those. A person could overdose who is recreationally using drugs. And, you know, we don't condone drug use. We don't approve of drug use. But if someone has an addiction, they have a disease, and it's our job.
That's Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Leanna Nguyen talking about the fact that we are
running out
of Narcan.
Running out. And as a matter of fact, when she talked about rationing the drug, and she said, and so that was definitely, the word rationing is definitely one that should be of concern. So that means that they have to give it out to people who are the most high risk. So for example, someone who is going to the needle exchange program most likely is going to have an opportunity to be around people who are using opioids, so they get first access to this. But it is something that pretty much anyone who lives in Baltimore City should have on hand. And what was scary is when she said not only are they rationing it, but she said that it is likely their supply, without help from the federal government or our state, it is likely their supply will run out by the end of July.
Wow. And, you know, what's part of the problem that she talked about was the increase in the price. Vizio, which is one, basically it's very similar to the EpiPen thing, I think, where the delivery mechanism is patented, so the drug itself is kind of generic. I think it isn't generic, but the little plastic thing that allows you to shoot into someone, mm-hmm. or the nasal spray has been patented. So like Avizio, which is one of the ones that they initially gave free to the health department, has quadrupled or five times the price, from $600 to $4,500.
And the Evzio injectable, mm-hmm. the price has gone up seven, like it's not, I don't know how to say times seven, in under 2 years.
Yeah.
So not doubled, not tripled, but it's gone up an increase of seven times.
The other thing she talked about, and we have asked the governor, she said that the state has not released money that was supposed to be dedicated to funding purchasing this, because basically she has written a prescription for the entire city.
Right.
So any person can go in and get it. But the state, she said the state has not released funds that were supposed to be part of Governor Larry Hogan's, you know, sort of response to the opiate crisis. We asked Governor Hogan's office for comment, and we have not heard back. So I don't know what's going on with that, but that strikes me as quite disturbing, or, you know, problematic, that there's no city that has more compelling case to need this drug, and that the state has not released funds when you have all this political hand-wringing over the opiate crisis and the debate about it. Mm.
Dr. Nguyen, just a programming note, will be on with my brother Changa Bell, host of the Relationship Experience, after First Edition. Dr. Nguyen will be on with Changa Bell. So she, I'm no doubt, will talk more about the opioid crisis, which has been a crisis for decades in Baltimore, mm-hmm. City. Again, that is an ongoing theme for us here on First, mm-hmm. Edition, and in the Mod Squad segment as well. It literally blows my mind that now in 2017,
right.
heroin has been discovered.
Yes, it turns out that this people heroin. Are addicted, yeah. and that they're overdosing. Yeah. But I think that we actually had the statistic that it is now the leading cause of death
for people under the age of 50.
And there were
1.3 million emergency room visits throughout the country. But of course, as Sean, you point out, this has been something that's been afflicting Baltimore for, you know, decades. And mm-hmm. I remember back 10 years ago, we had the highest rate of overdose deaths of any jurisdiction. It's doubled since then, which is amazing to think about.
That is amazing. Thank you.
You see here the intersection of politics where, you know, the state, the governor will not respond. The city health commissioner has to go on TV and with other news organizations to exhort him. And beg for money. But also, similarly, the pharmaceutical companies, who the people that started this crisis by selling OxyContin,
candy, they're profiting.
Now they're profiting. It is really, you think about it, a horrible sort of apocalyptic way of running a society, that you would certainly have companies saying, take as much OxyContin as you can, mm-hmm. and we'll invent this thing called fentanyl, and you're really like that. Mm-hmm. And then when I come up with it, this is a generic. It's just like EpiPens, in terms of having a generic substance in it. But they make these injectors, and now they're charging $4,500.
Yes. I mean, $4,500 per dose.
But you know what what this is really based on? It's based on the fact that America, especially, is an addictive society, an addictive culture. I mean, we can talk about on the extreme end, mm-hmm. heroin and fentanyl and OxyContin,
yeah.
Ketone,
and all of these
drugs. But we're also addicted to sugar. We're also addicted to caffeine. We're also mm-hmm. addicted to nicotine. We're addicted to alcohol. America is an addiction driven society,
sure,
well, but country.
But the thing is, who is considered an addict has changes, with the political winds. And for example, the addicts at the turn of the century, in the late 1800s, there were almost 100,000 white women, middle class and up, that were addicted to opioids because their doctors would prescribe it to them for hysteria mm-hmm. and female complaints. And at that time period, it was considered... yes, it does. It helps you with your hysteria. And at that time period, people who, of color were considered unable to become addicted to opioids because they didn't have the temperament and mental faculties to be able to become addicted to an opioid. So it was for people who were nervous and had intellectual neuroses and hysteria.
Well, and I also think, you know, Sean, you make a good point that this country sort of tends, because of its sort of very, you know, divisive system of capitalism, tends to manufacture a great deal of despair because people kind of get left behind in many different facets. And we're not much about saying, you know, that everyone in a community has to have a role to play, and not much. We don't put like things like the quality of people's lives. We're economically fierce. We sublimate violence in so many ways. And so I think we're big manufacturer of despair. We you know, and I think despair is something we don't really think about, and it's probably better for Chang and Bell show. But nevertheless, you know, when you saw it infect Baltimore in the 70s when the jobs disappeared and people's middle class lifestyles disappeared, and suddenly, you know, what came in but, you know, heroin. And
well, one of my favorite filmmakers, Michael Moore, made a movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, talking about how America has manufactured despair and fear and marketed it and profited billions over with those two items. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoz, your host. I'm in the studio with the Mod Squad. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network.
And you think about, where would Trump be without fear? He'd be nowhere.
He wouldn't be the 45th.
But we have to place, you know, some of this blame on our economic system, our neoliberal capitalist system here. The thing is that the Bayer company, the ones who make aspirin, were the ones who originally marketed heroin in America.
Right.
The Bayer aspirin company. Mm-hmm.
As an alternative to morphine, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because it was less addictive than morphine, according to the Bayer company.
Yeah.
So when we have this profit motive within our healthcare, when the OxyContin Corporation, who started pushing their drugs, made plush toys and mugs and bracelets and all types of things to give to doctors as they were encouraging them to liberally prescribe OxyContin. That profit motive that underlies it, that allows a drug company to addict a population and then to jack up the price on the life-saving drug for the population that they addicted, it's practically criminal.
And then, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say Big Pharma is one of the most criminal industries in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no other way to talk about it.
Some of the cruelest drug dealers around.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
And wealthier than
the money they make is just astounding. And then to think about it, just think about the correlation where they flooded the market with OxyContin and then they create something like Narcan, Narcan, and sell it back. It's like, that is the worst drug deal in the world.
And then jack up the price on the Narcan as the need for it increases.
And the fact that no one in our government has the political will to decipher this problem and say, oh, this is wrong. Even Democrat, Republican, who cares who they are? No one ever wakes up in the morning and says,
and
this
stands
is ridiculous.
Up to them.
That's because these pharma companies.
They pass the money, baby.
Man, they get, I'm sure that every one of those guys, I don't care whether you like Democrats or Republicans, gets huge checks from pharma and won't do. It's just,
par for the course. Let's take some phone calls. I know people want to talk about probably the previous conversations as well as what we just talked about. Let's go to Oscar first in Baltimore. Oscar, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Doing fine. Good evening.
Hey, Oscar.
Your first topic, it's not, I know you talk a lot about the police in Baltimore, but I think you're now saying it's not a Baltimore problem.
No, I agree.
It happens everywhere.
Yes.
I mean,
that is true.
A woman in Seattle, a pregnant woman, just been killed by the police, those who had obviously had mental problems. She was killed.
Right, I heard about that.
They had another guy, they're retrying a case. Where this guy, I think this is in Minnesota also, he jumped over the fence. He had a gun, and the police shot him in the arm. He threw the gun down, didn't have it. He was laying on the ground. They shot and killed him. Mm. He was found not guilty. I mean, so really, and I hate to say this. No, I don't hate to say it. This is true. This is not so much a police problem. It's a race problem, honest to God, because for the most part, white people, that's why they can't get convictions. Because the white juries are not going to find police. I don't care what color the police are. They're not going to find him guilty for shooting black. If they find any least excuse, they're not going to find him guilty. They're just not going to do it. And if we think it's not a race problem, there's no rhyme or reason for a person like Donald Trump, who's obviously mentally insane and a criminally insane, to be president of the United States. Mm-hmm. You saw what happened in Georgia last night. That woman had no business winning that. But white people are saying, we don't care if the person incompetent or not. If they show signs or prove to us that they are racist and against other people of color, we will put them in office, make them president of the United States, right. King of Siam. It doesn't matter.
All right, Oscar, thank you for your call. Appreciate you.
He makes some good points.
Always does, actually. Let's go to Dwayne in Baltimore City. Dwayne, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you?
Yeah. So as far as our police have created a culture where it's almost just like a circus show. You know, they create this environment over the last 50 to 60 years, you know, of racism towards people of color, of course, and then people of color, and knowing that, well, not knowing, or maybe knowing and not caring, that the only end could be people of color will start to strike back in ways that, you know, that the society doesn't want, and then wonder why they have to unhook their guns every time they see a black person after treating black people like poop for the past 50 to 60 years, or if not longer, as long as they've been police, they treated black people poorly. As far as our economic system, you know, I hear what you guys are saying, and you guys are right. It's not a moral system. Our economic system is not moral. It's capitalistic. So, of course, drug companies are going to take advantage of the fact that there's more demand for their supply. And they've had Narcan for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
But it just so happens that now there's a huge need for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's right, but that's just our system. Our system is capitalistic. Of course, Big Pharma is paying for our congressmen to take trips and do all this wonderful stuff. So, of course, they're not gonna disrupt the pipeline. Mm-hmm. That's capitalism. Capital taking advantage of financial situations that allow you to gain power and or more profit. That's right. Capitalism. It's in every cell and fiber of the American culture.
It's the American capitalism. Way, mm-hmm. as Ice Cube right. said. Thank you, Dwayne. Appreciate
thank you.
Let's go to Brother Leo Burrows in Bolton Hill. Brother Burrows, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Yes, good evening, my friends, one more time.
Hey, good brother. Evening, good Brother Burrows.
Well, Charmaine Wilson, in imminent danger, and folks said, let her eat cake. Mm. And so she gets killed, and we go around and around, the Dawson family, and on we go. Genocide is the systematic extermination of a people. Can we make the case before the United Nations? I'm not sure we can make it before the U.S. Congress, but can we make it the case before the United Nations that the United States is engaging in patterns, practices, and policies attendant to genocide? Can we make that case, and should we utilize that strategy in an effort to end the systematic extermination of a people that's currently going on in this country, i.e. the police department, the Fraternal Order of Police, the National Rifle Association, and big business?
Mm. Well, I mean...
What do we do?
Sean, you were there, right, when they came? Hmm? When the UN came here?
Yes,
right?
I was. I facilitated a meeting when a representative of the United Nations came to study Baltimore, basically, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In wake of the uprising. And I wrote about it in my column as well. So Brother Burrows makes a very cogent point.
Yes.
But also, I think there's another point to be made, and we've made it on this show before. The cause for reparations specifically applied to local jurisdictions like Baltimore, where citizens, thousands of them, stand in need of being repaired for decades of abuse by mm-hmm. many different systems, not just law enforcement. So that's a whole nother conversation, but they're connected.
Absolutely.
Let's take one more call. Let's go to Brother Ock next. Brother Ock, you're on with Mod Squad. How you doing?
All right. How y'all doing?
All right.
Good, good.
Good evening.
Yeah, I'll make it real quick. We just need to start following these pigs home and find out what they have for breakfast. Bacon, no doubt. Have a good one.
All right, Ock. I mean,
sorry.
Wow.
I mean, that's to the point.
To the point.
It's to the point, but it speaks to to people's anger, mm-hmm. and whether or not it's incendiary, whether or not, you know, some people would be offended by that, some people would be. Mm-hmm. There are police officers that do great work. They should of be course. Offended. But the reality is people were angry. I mean, people were angry about Charmaine Wilson. I write about her in my mm-hmm. column this week. You know, the police were gone. And the police couldn't, they could not have protected, I don't know if they could have protected Charmaine Wilson, mm-hmm. quite frankly. Right. But the reality is that she had called on different occasions for protection for her and her family. But this poor, literally poor woman with eight children living in Southwest Baltimore in a housing authority home apartment, mm-hmm. There's no protection for her.
There wasn't anything there to protect her. I mean, you can't say, oh, well, we're going to move you out of town for a few months while your children aren't going to be able to go to school. What could they have possibly offered her except maybe a patrol car in front of her house 24 hours a day?
But it wasn't even plausible given the circumstances. And ultimately, there are thousands of Charmaine Wilsons in our city, and that's the whole problem. The problem is that we are living in this precarious situation. This isn't a law enforcement's fault. Right. We're living in a city that poverty, crime, violence permeates the air mm-hmm. in certain neighborhoods.
Right.
In other neighborhoods, they live with impunity.
And if she had been bold enough to, let's say, have a gun, get a permit to keep a gun in her own home, we know how badly that can turn out mm-hmm. with Philando Castile. Do you think people would have had the same sympathy if they'd known that she was a gun owner and had threatened to fight back? Yeah. Is that what we need to do? Do we need to take this matter into our own hands and defend our own homes? Because we cannot, at this time, trust the police to protect and serve.
On that note, we are going to have to end the conversation because we're out of time. The Mod Squad is Terry mm-hmm. Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. My friends, you'll be here on Friday.
Yes, we will.
You'll
yes,
be sitting in for me.
We'll be sitting for you, yes.
Yes.
Isn't that something?
We'll try. Yeah.
You're going to do it. You've got it.
All right.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon will be here. She's founder of the Instrumo Academy for Holistic Thought. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. ¶¶